One of the unfortunate parts about our kind of enterprise is that you're not given the opportunity very often to really get into the facts and history and background and culture of any one place. Some of the more successful people in my business are successful largely because they write about a country after being there about 3 or 4 months, which is a good practice from a journalistic point of view, because I've always discovered that when you're there a year or two, you find so many exceptions to the generalities that we are forced to use that you hesitate to use them. And the result is that you're usually tongue-tied and your hands are tied and you don't write anything. That is one of the failings of our business, and I want you to realize, and I'm sure you do without my saying it, that I am not talking to you either as an expert on American affairs or on foreign affairs, but as somebody who is inexpert on all these affairs and therefore indulges in generalities which are, for the most part, half true and half untrue. The text of the sermon that I've been brought here to give you, I take from a speech that was delivered in Tucson, Arizona, while I was there, by the Justice of the Supreme Court, whose name sometimes irritates people, William O. Douglas. I say it irritates people because he says irritating things, and he was speaking to the Bar Association in Tucson, Arizona, and he said some things that irritated its members from apparent evidence. And the lesson for today's talk, America at the Barricades, comes from him. And the words that I wish to quote, and they're very short, are these. The world is different than we in America have thought. There are two variations of this theme that I want to talk to you about today. There are many others that I will mention, but only two that I want to talk about. Unfortunately, I believe your last speaker, Mr. Nuveen, who accounts for my being a registered member of the Republican Party because I entered a primary to vote for him for Congress. I don't know him. Mr. Nuveen, I think, talked on a subject rather closely related to one aspect of this theme that Justice Douglas brought out in Arizona. So I will, with your permission, not emphasize that too much because I think we'll repeat ourselves, Mr. Nuveen and myself. One side of the coin, of the coin that Justice Douglas was talking about in Tucson, he described this way. Reporters who traveled the back countries over the years have told us what was happening in the world, but we would not and did not listen. The plain fact is that the world is in a revolution which cannot be bought off with dollars. Ideas, not dollars, count. Dollars are secondary. Nor can we possibly defend with our armies the wide perimeter from Japan to Cairo, which is in a revolutionary state. Our only real defense, said Justice Douglas, against communism, our only real defense is a political offensive, with action rather than with rhetoric. The hour is late, but so long as World War III has not struck, it is not too late. Now, I take it that is more or less the general theme of Mr. Nuveen's talk. And so that is what I want to say less about, or least about, today. But I do want to say it because I think it's so important and so vital to understanding what I mean by this title, America at the Barricades. I recall very clearly the years 1933 to 1939 in Western Europe, because those were the years when I was active as a correspondent for the United Press and was sent around to most of the places involved in Hitler's war of conquest. I recall most clearly of all the utter despondency that used to come over us, many of us, in the business of reporting, when we set down our glasses of bourbon and water long enough to recall and remember that what we were saying and what we knew to be true was simply not believed or accepted by the leaders of our governments, all of the Western governments, including the Roosevelt administration in the United States. The feeling that we had was so deep in us that we largely ignored it in our own conversations. It was taken for granted. Shortly after the Spanish Civil War developed into the International War, it was taken for granted that the Western countries would not understand what it was all about and would aid the fascist Nazi powers, which they did, including the United States government. And it was taken for granted after a while, and we didn't talk about it, that war was coming, that the fascists and Nazis could not be appeased, they could not be bribed, that their economies and their society had been created, and we saw it created from the beginning, for the sole purpose of waging a war of conquest, and that it simply had to carry out that purpose. It was impossible not to carry it out. Socially and economically impossible for Germany to remain at peace, unless, of course, everybody surrendered. And we knew that they would not, in the last time, surrender. We knew that, and yet we could not get people to understand it. And we saw our governments, all of our Western governments, going down the road to war. And we knew it was the road to war, and there was nothing we could do about it. And report and make speeches and write articles, all you want, it made no difference. Now, I recall that period for two reasons. First, it seems to me to resemble, in many respects, the present period and our attitude, especially our attitude this time, in the way that Justice Douglas and I think Mr. Nuveen meant last week when Nuveen, or last time when Nuveen spoke to you. And this is what I mean. People have been telling, reporters, as Justice Douglas says, have been telling us about this revolutionary movement, this revolutionary force among the disfranchised, poverty-stricken people of the globe. It hasn't yet reached its full force in Africa, but with the exception of Africa, every place else, in the Oriental world at least, there is that revolutionary movement. They have been telling us about it, starting with the late Wendell Willkie, or including him, when he was laughed out of court for talking about it. We have known about it. We have persisted in ignoring it and in doing the same sort of thing as the Western powers and the United States did in that period between 1933 and 39. In this case, we have insisted that all these troubles in the world, all these disturbances and changes and violence is caused by something we call communism or Soviet communism, imperialism, or whatever you want to call it. It's caused by these men in Moscow. And that if we can somehow get rid of them, we will cure it and it won't happen again. Now, I think it's as clear now as it was in 1933 to 39 about this other matter, it's as clear now that if Stalin and all of his supporters in Russia were to be so kind as to commit suicide at this moment, and the communist parties of the world disappeared, and Methodists or Quakers or Baptists took control of the Soviet Union, and communists became angels, or if not angels, American Democrats, which is the next thing to angels. If all that happened, these troubles, these disturbances, these revolts, this violence, these problems of ours, of the world, would not disappear. True, they might diminish in many places, because the communists do use them and are attempting to exploit them to their own, for their own benefit, and are succeeding. They would be a lessening, perhaps, of tension or a lessening of violence, but they would not disappear. China would not become, once again, peacefully a despotism of the 16th or 17th century, which it has been in our lifetime. It would not return to that. And though we may fool ourselves into thinking that temporary counter-revolutionary regimes, such as that of General Franco in Spain, are an answer, they are not, in my opinion, an answer. The late violence in parts of Spain, in Barcelona, probably will not lead to a revolution, but it's the beginning. The people of Spain are not going to remain in a medieval 16th century country forever in the 20th century. They won't do it. Someday they will reach at least the French Revolution. And they'll do it violently, as long as they're held down the way they are. And the Chinese have and would have their revolution with or without Stalin and the communists. And so I say the first barricade, if you will, that confronts us is, like, in my opinion, most of the principal barricades before us, our own creation. And it's the barricade that we can get over regardless, or as I used to say, irregardless, of whether or not Stalin likes it or doesn't like it, or does this or does that, or exists or doesn't exist. We ourselves can decide whether or not we are in favor or against these revolutionary movements. And if we are against them, then we should do certain things, some of which we have been doing. If we are in favor of them, we should do many things, most of which we have not been doing. And we can decide that ourselves and can take the consequences of our decision. Now, I don't know that in a country this size and as complicated as ours, such decisions ever can be made in a democratic way, but they are made, whether they are made in a democratic way or not, and action is taken upon them, and I believe so far our decision has been to be the leading counter-revolutionary of the world and to attempt to stop this revolutionary movement. And I believe that decision is wrong and will lead to failure and will bring us nothing but loss of blood and capital in useless wars. I believe that that movement cannot be stopped by the regimes now available, the counter-revolutionary regimes now available to stop it. And whether we like it or not, it's a revolution we must see and understand and take part in. Now, I said in the beginning that there were other sides to this barricades topic that I wanted to mention in passing, and this is one. Part of our failure, it seems to me, in not seeing and not understanding, or in trying not to understand, because we make a very great effort not to understand, part of that failure, that weakness, results from a hysterical or quasi-hysterical attitude developing in this country toward, for lack of a better word, radicals, toward people who are espousing or holding or once held views now considered dangerous and subversive. The reason I say that is this, that since we are dealing with revolutions, and since due to our withdrawal from the stage and our refusal to participate as leaders in these revolutions, since because of that, the communists have gone into every one of these movements, and as in Spain, actually grabbed control of it before it failed, since that happened, people who have worked within those revolutionary groups as scientists, as reporters, as students of any kind, naturally are tainted with association with communists. Anyone who has made any effort to study the present government of China before it became the government of China naturally had to deal with communists. Now, if we exclude them and their knowledge and their advice and judgment because we consider them potentially subversive or dangerous, and I'm thinking of men, say, like Owen Latimer, who may be wrong or right, but he did have that experience. If we exclude them from our public judgments, from our public discussions, from our officials when they are attempting to make a judgment. We are simply forcing ignorance upon ourselves or deepening it. We are rejecting possible correct knowledge. We are being as unscientific and as bigoted as possible, and we are doing that. About the only agencies of the government who dare, I believe, consult people in that category are the secret agencies, who are protected from Congress and the people and the press because they can't be discussed or investigated. And so they have enough nerve to go out and find Americans who know most about one of these areas and consult them for information.